Okay, we'll get started again. So, again, we've sort of broken the back of this lecture in terms of concepts. Sort of the big thing is sort of what techniques do we use to estimate our system parameters, and sort of taking on board why we need multiple samples and why a single sample, or sort of why a single run typically isn't enough. And then sort of how the non-deterministic nature is still at play, and so as well as a number, we need some estimate of how good that number is. Okay, so we demonstrated that with our estimation of mean. There are other values that can also be estimated, and again, we can look at sort of things related to probability distributions. So actually mapping out a distribution or calculating percentiles, and that's again points that give you sort of certain percentages, or sort of encompass certain percentages of a population. And finally, again, we'll say a few words about variance. It's a bit more complicated. Okay. So, again, to calculate these other quantities is going to be, it's the same procedure as we used before. We're going to have a number of runs. We calculate our quantity, whatever it is, for each run. And then our estimator is the average value we calculate of over all the runs. Okay. So here we ask, what's the probability of a customer waiting more than 5 minutes for service? So how would we calculate that for any given run? Well, we look at the total number of customers, and then we look at the ones who wait more than 5 minutes, and obviously the ratio of those gives us our sample estimate. Again, we're going to need a sort of long enough run that estimate is sort of typical. Okay. Now, if we have n runs, we take the average over all of our sample estimates. Okay. And sort of in general, we can do this. We can sort of sort out at least a rough distribution for our variable. So think of you can think of a single interval, or you can think of sort of breaking the whole probability space up into a number of intervals, and then you have something like, you're building up something like a histogram, okay, where you know the ratio of the number in a certain bin to the total number gives you something like a probability. Okay. So, again, we can do this in a quite straightforward fashion. We have some interval I, and each time we run the simulation, we observe how many times whatever our quantity is lies within I, divide that by the total number of observations, and again, the probability is just the ratio of the number that fell into the interval over the full number. Okay. We do that over multiple runs. We then take the average over the multiple runs and calculate our unbiased estimator for our variance. Okay. And so we have exactly the same things we had before. We have an estimator for our probability, which is in itself probabilistic. We have, it has a certain mean. We have our estimator for the variance. And we can calculate our confidence interval given those values. This is just a note that, you know, there's a number of different ways you can gather that statistic. Here you're essentially just doing a count as you run along. Okay. So for calculating the probability that you're in some interval, you essentially have some probability distribution which you're trying to estimate, and you've fixed the interval over which you wish to estimate it. Again, a percentile is sort of the opposite question. It's if you want a certain portion of your population to lie within an interval, in this case the interval is from 0 to, or well, from one end of the population to the other, to a certain point, what's actually the size of your interval? Okay. And so a more formal way of phrasing that is if we have a cumulative distribution function for some random variable, beta will be some number between 0 and 1. And so think about 0.95 again as our canonical example. Then if beta is 0.95, you're looking for the 95th percentile. And it's the smallest value so that your cumulative cumulative density function is less than beta, so less than 0.95. So there it is. Okay, so again, if you remember, you have x, and your cumulative density function f of x. That should be some function that's increasing up to 1. And so we have our beta here, and 95% of the population is sort of in here. Okay. And so, you know, again, just if you go back to the beginning of the lecture, we had an example where we asked what's the maximum waiting time experienced by 95% of our arrivals. Okay. And so if we want to answer that, well, what we have to do is calculate a bunch of waiting times, 100, 1,000, and then count up, you know, order those waiting times, and count up till you've gone through 95% of them. Okay, so if you had 100, well, then you order them and you look at the 95th one. Okay, so that's the 95th largest waiting time. Okay. So last time we were asking about a specific waiting time of 5 minutes, and what percentage would experience it or experience something greater. Now we're asking, if we look at everybody, how many of them are going to experience what's the waiting time that 95% of them will experience, sort of an upper bound on that. Okay. So, again, as I just described, you can make a run, and based on the observations for that run, you can come up with a sample value. Okay, and then to come up with our estimator, we just average all of our sample values. Obviously, values come in integer values, so you have to round up or down, just be consistent about how you do your rounding. Okay. If you've taken that average, well, you can also calculate the variance estimate in the same way. So you have your average value, and you can calculate your confidence interval. Okay. Now, what becomes hard is calculating extremes of distribution. So again, if you think typically about how things are distributed, you will tend to have sort of common values, and then as you go out, your values get farther and farther away. So that's sort of typically the type of samples you'd expect to see. And so what the problem is with calculating extremes is the distance between these values. So it makes a big difference if one of these exists or not. If you're trying to pick a value in here, obviously what you get is going to depend a lot on sort of whether this is the 95th or this one's the 95th. Okay, so you have to take very large samples to try and capture enough of this tail distribution to be useful. Okay, now, the last thing people sometimes look at is variance. And we can sort of, again, go at this in a similar fashion. We can calculate sort of the variance for any individual run, and then calculate an overall average variance. The problem here is that our variance calculations for each run are all dependent on this mu bar bar squared, and therefore they are not independent. Okay. So all our estimates, our whole trick worked, in terms of the central limit theorem, because we assumed that our estimators were independent. Here we do not have independent estimators. They're correlated in some way, and so the trick doesn't hold. Okay. I'm not going to go into any great detail, but just again be aware that you have, in this case, you would have to use some technique to deal with the correlation between the values. So I throw it in more to make you aware that our technique is nice, it's great, it's fun, it works a lot of times and gives us a lot of useful information, but it doesn't always work, and you have to be, therefore, careful when you think about it. Okay. So, again, we've now got sort of a method for estimating various system quantities and sort of estimating how close those the estimators are to the actual system quantity. Okay. And again, what I've said so far is that the way you produce these estimators is you make a number of runs, being careful to make sure that you're actually getting steady state observations as opposed to transient state observations, etc. But we still do M independent runs. Okay. Now, this is not the only way. We'll look at that's all the M independent runs is what we call replications, and we'll look at that method and say a few more words about it. A second means of gathering our data is the batch means, and here we're going to essentially increase the length of the runs and look sort of at segments of runs and argue about whether that does or does not come close to the actual behavior we're looking for. Okay, Peros mentions a third method, the regenerative method. We're not going to discuss this. It's applicable under a somewhat restrictive set of assumptions about the system behavior, so we'll use our we'll look at our more general methods. Okay, so our replication method is what we have been looking at the whole time. We have N runs, and we gather our statistics on the N runs. Okay, and the main complication is ensuring that the runs have reached steady state. There is also an issue now with choosing how many runs we wish to make. Okay. And the issue here is surrounding the confidence interval. We said we had a rule of thumb that 30 runs gave us a normal distribution, but the confidence interval is dependent on the variance, okay? And so the number of runs, the more runs you have, also serves to reduce the variance of your variables, of your estimator. So you also might calculate the number of runs you need to produce a confidence interval of a certain size. Okay. So if you remember, we had our 95% as our confidence level, and we got U minus, what was the value, 1.96, sigma, U plus 1.96 sigma. And so, in that case, obviously the exact size of your confidence interval is dependent on what sigma is. The more runs you take, the smaller sigma is. So how many runs you can be, that can indicate how many runs you need as well. Okay. And so if you want to figure this out, well, one method is to perform some fixed number of runs. That gives you one estimate of sigma, and then again to realize that it varies with the square root of n, so you can again put that's a point on a known curve so you can figure out what the rest of the curve is. Okay. The other method is to just keep doing runs and sort of calculate your variance on the fly and stop when you have achieved your desired accuracy. Okay, so that's just, again, an issue about sort of getting appropriate confidence intervals. Now, in the batch method, we take a different approach in which we now look at very long runs and now break the runs up into segments. Okay. And then we calculate our statistics on each of the individual segments. Okay. So if we're taking an average, our first sample point is the average over batch 1, our second sample point is the average over batch 2, our third sample point is the average over batch 3, our kth sample point is the average over batch k. Now, the benefit of this is that you essentially have one long run. You don't need to worry about your transient period, or well, you only have one transient period to deal with. Can anybody think of why, any issues that there might be with this? So, it comes back to, again, sort of individual samples, and we now will have correlation between sort of the individual samples, and therefore there will be some correlation between one batch and another batch, particularly if the batches are close together. Again, if this is waiting time, if that's high, this one's likely to be high, etc. Okay. So, there's a couple of points to be made about that. The first one is, if we take our batch size big enough, it's sort of like a transient period, we assume that the period of correlation is between one batch and that the amount of correlation between one batch and another is small. Again, it happens around the boundaries, but as you get farther away, there's less correlation. So potentially, if you take sort of big enough batch sizes, you can ignore this correlation effect. Okay, and again, go back to assuming that, at least in terms of something like an average, that the two batches, or the values you get, are independent. If you're using the batch method, it's always a good idea to check out whether that's true or not, and we'll, again, say a few words about calculating correlation between batches. And finally, if they are correlated, there are some methods for accounting for correlations while still using our techniques. Okay. And so, again, the number of batches is going to be determined by how small you want your confidence intervals to be. Okay. So our final topic here is to deal with correlation. And correlation, it's a measure of relatedness between random variables. If a variable is uncorrelated, then knowing the value of one does not in any way tell you the value of the other. If there is correlation, then knowing the value of one at least gives you some information about the value of the other. Okay. And so this is measured through covariance and then the normalization of covariance. So covariance between x and y is the expected value of x minus mu times y, x minus mu x times y minus mu y. And again, if they're independent, your covariance is zero. If they're equal, then your covariance is just the same as the variance. Okay. Now, we want sort of a standardized measure, so we normalize according to the variance. So to get the correlation, we divide our covariance factor by the variance of x times the variance of y. Okay. What this does, again, is give us a measure of the relatedness between two variables. Okay. What we have been assuming so far, again, is that they're not related, although we observed, again, with the estimation of variance for the system that those variables actually were related. Okay. And so what we want now is to get some feel for the relatedness of a sequence of variables. And we do that by what's called calculating lag correlations. And so essentially what we do is we tot up pairwise correlations between a sequence and the sequence shifted by a certain number of places. And again, the less you shift it, the higher you'd expect the correlation to be. Okay. So for a lag 1 autocorrelation, we shift our sequence by 1 and calculate the the correlation between them, the covariance, and then normalize over your variance. Okay, and again, you can go and shift that by some number other than 1, which is not what I did here, shifted it by 1 again. Okay, well, shift it by some number other than 1, and sort of again calculate that pairwise correlation, but again, with a shift somewhere other than 1. Okay. And so sort of the assumption is that sort of the more you shift, the farther away, or sort of the smaller the correlation is going to be. Okay. And so typically you don't go too far out. Okay, and finally, the way the correlation is used. Well, again, it's good to run those, if you're using something like a batch method, it's good to run those tests anyway, but it can also be used to adjust for the correlation. And so you just essentially have a function which now is a weighted, your estimate for variance is now your first estimate, which again is what's correct if you have no correlation, but then you introduce a correction factor which takes into account this lagged correlation and it does it in a sort of weighted manner. Okay. And so this gives you a better estimate of your variance to be used to in calculating confidence intervals. Okay. So again, the core of this lecture is the idea of how you estimate system parameters, and since they are probabilistic, sort of how you calculate then confidence intervals to measure how close they are to the actual parameter. Okay. And so, again, when we're doing this, we generally make the assumption that there is no correlation between our sample estimates contributing to the overall estimate. If there is, then we have to calculate the correlation and adjust accordingly. Okay. Now, I'm just going to say a few words on validation. We'll be returning to this in a few weeks, mainly in sort of giving measurements about, again, how close probabilistic distributions are to sort of sample data. And so one question which we've sort of sidestepped is, so we have this nice model, we've analyzed it now. How do we determine whether the model is correct in the sense of whether it's representing what we think it is? Okay. And so in order to determine this, typically you check your input and output against sort of whatever data that you have. Okay. Obviously, that only works if you have an existing system. If you're sort of designing a wholly new system, then you sort of just have to make clever arguments that this really does what you think your future system will do. But if you do have a system, then you should have some idea of what the actual inputs of the system are, and you can compare that to your inputs, or sort of your model of the inputs. And again, you'd have outputs from the system, and you can compare them to your observed traces. Okay. And so again, there's various ways of shaping or of sort of comparing your data to your model. typically if you have a lot of data, you can use, again, a histogram to roughly estimate the distribution of your data and then compare it to your modeled distribution. Again, there are techniques which we'll look into later to see sort of how close that fit is. And similarly for the output, you can come up with a distribution, you can compare the actual output to your simulated output and see, again, how close those are. So, in a few weeks, we'll be looking again at this measure of closeness and say a few more words about it then. Now, the first assignment, there will be two assignments. The first one, which is worth more credits, it's worth about two-thirds of the credits on offer for continuous assessment, will be posted hopefully sort of towards the beginning of next week. And whenever I do this final simulation-related lecture, which I'll let you know when that is, it'll be a few weeks. You'll have seen the assignment. You should have a look. You should try your best. But I'll bring a demonstrator in at that point, and we'll have a small session, small help session as well. But again, the help session's much more use if you've actually tried to do it yourself before you attend the session. So that's it for today. Next week we'll be back to for the next 2 weeks we'll be back to Connor McArdle, and he'll be talking about queues. Okay, so have a good weekend. I hope the weather improves, and I will see you all in a few weeks.